Hello there. Today is Thursday, September 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another monster storm is causing major destruction as it barrels toward the U.S. mainland.
But certainly residents along the coast of Florida and all the way up across the southeast need to pay attention to this storm and to make necessary preparations.
We hear from a man who came here as a child from Mexico and now fears deportation. The latest on the Russia investigation. Also ahead, the hidden meaning behind pop singer Taylor Swift's new single. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Caribbean island of Barbuda is completely isolated after taking a direct hit from Hurricane Irma, the strongest Atlantic storm in recorded history. There's no power on Barbuda and no way to communicate with the outside world. Now, while an exact forecast is nearly impossible to nail down, Florida Governor Rick Scott is telling people to prepare now. He said the storm is likely to affect the entire state, and he has activated the National Guard.
The Guard will initially be helping with shelter operations and evacuations. After the storm hits, they will work with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission on search and rescue operations. National Guard members will also be assisting utility companies following the storm as they respond to return power to homes and businesses. 13 helicopters and more than 1,000 tactical high water vehicles are on standby ready to be deployed. By using resources from other states, we also have 30,000 troops, 4,000 trucks, 100 helicopters, and air evacuation crews ready to support our state.
Well, joining me now for the latest on this monster storm is meteorologist Bruce Sullivan with the National Weather Prediction Center. Thank you for being with us. So what's the status of Irma right now?
It is still a Category 5 hurricane, so it's still maintaining some very strong winds. It is expected to remain a pretty powerful storm as it continues to move west-northwestward.
Where is it at this point, and where is it headed as far as you can tell right now?
Well, it's about 40 miles off the north coast of Puerto Rico, and it's continuing to move very slowly, about 16 miles an hour to the west-northwest. That track is expected to continue overnight and through the day on Thursday.
Is it still too soon to know as far as how much the U.S. mainland will get?
It's still a little too early to tell. The system is expected to move toward the southern coast of Florida as we get in towards Saturday. At that point, the models are trying to show that the system may slow and eventually turn northward. At this point, it's a little too early to say when exactly that turn will happen, but certainly residents along the coast of Florida and all the way up across the southeast need to pay attention to this storm and to make necessary preparations in case they're impacted.
At what point do you think it'll become more clear as to where this thing is headed as far as the U.S. goes?
Right now, currently, the National Hurricane Center has the center projected to be near the southeast coast of Florida by Sunday. We're still 3 or 4 days out before the center actually would make impact along the southeast coast. But we really need to not focus so much on the actual center, because this is a pretty big system with the gale force winds extending 150 miles or so away from the center. So a lot of damage can be done with the system and not specifically at the center, although that's usually where the strongest winds are.
What is a storm like this capable of doing?
The real concerns with this type of storm is considerable wind damage. Rain can produce floods and certainly mudslides over higher terrain. Anyone who lives near the coastal areas, a considerable storm surge can occur with these types of systems, anywhere from 10 to 20 feet depending on the orientation of the coastlines. And that comes quickly, and that can cause considerable damage and loss of life. Anyone that really lives near coastal areas needs to really pay attention to the storm over the next several days and make necessary preparations now in case you need to evacuate.
Well, President Trump has ordered the Federal Emergency Management Agency to begin relief efforts even as it continues assisting in the cleanup of southeast Texas, which is still reeling from the devastation brought on by Hurricane Harvey. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Donald Trump Jr. will be testifying privately on Russia before the U.S. Senate panel tomorrow. Donald Trump says a military action against North Korea certainly is not the first choice. The Pope arrives in Colombia seeking to heal the conflict's wounds. And a DNA test on Salvador Dali's remains disproves a paternity claim. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, time is in short supply for 800,000 people who moved to the U.S. as children without documentation, but have held temporary legal status under an Obama-era policy. President Trump has given Congress 6 months to do what it has been unable to do for 16 years, agree on a formula for granting them permanent status before he begins phasing out the program entirely. We're joined now by Ramon Ramirez, a DACA recipient who came here as a child and is now a teacher. Tell us how you got to America.
When I was 3 years old, my parents decided to move to the United States. During the early 90s, Mexico was the economy was headed south. So they tried to be proactive and just try to jump to the next best opportunity for them, and that was immigrating to the United States. And so we came here at the time with legal visas.
And so you've been in the United States since you were 3 years old, right?
Correct.
Can I ask how old you are now?
Yeah, I'm 24.
So what have you been doing for the last 21 years since you've been here?
I've pretty much been living a normal American life. When I was in high school, I was very active. I was part of the Future Business Leaders of America organization. I was in the Student Government Association. I had friends. We went to the football games. Once my junior year was about to start, I took a dual enrollment class at Christian Brothers University here in Memphis, which meant that I was taking a college class, and it would count towards my college transcript, and it would also count towards my high school transcript. And so I was initially getting a head start on my college career. And, you know, senior year came, I took my ACT. I did very well on it, got accepted into numerous colleges. But the kicker was that I was undocumented at the time. So a lot of colleges wouldn't even let me apply because at the time I did not have a Social Security number. However, because Christian Brothers is a private university here in Memphis, I was able to apply there, and they happily accepted me based on my academic merit. They even offered me a few private scholarships. So that's when I went to CBU. My parents helped pay for the rest of it. And in 2012, when I started CBU, that's when DACA came around. So that's when I was able to apply for DACA, got approved, which gave me a Social Security number, which in turn allowed me to work here in the U.S. I work at a retail store at the mall. But I was also, when I wasn't working, I was at school and I joined a fraternity. So I was still socially involved, pretty much like any other typical American college student. You know, I was pretty much doing everything that any normal person my age was doing, except, you know, I was under DACA.
Right.
But once I graduated, I had DACA, so I didn't have to worry of, oh, shoot, what happens when I graduate? And thanks to DACA, I was able to receive that work permit, which allowed me to get the job that I have right now, which is a teacher here in Memphis.
So how long have you been a teacher?
I just started my second year. I graduated last May.
What do you teach?
The middle schools. I do 7th grade social studies.
What are you feeling right now, given what transpired with the decision to rescind DACA?
Honestly, I felt very let down, disappointed, heartbroken, all at the same time. However, I was given a little glimpse of hope when Jeff Sessions announced there would be a 6-month delay. And actually, you know, essentially the president has given Congress 6 months to come up with a way to protect those former DACA recipients through the legislative branch rather than through an executive order.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives me hope.
Are you scared?
I am. I'm scared. Thankfully, they're allowing the work permits to go through through their expiration dates. They're not just rescinding it now, like send us here. So my work permit doesn't expire for another year and a half. So I have time to save up money or to be proactive and come up with another solution for myself. But at the same time, I'm also afraid that what if the administration changes its mind and they take away my work permit, or what if they use my personal information to come to my house and deport me? So I am afraid of that, and I am afraid that Congress won't get anything done. So I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid that, like, once again, Congress won't do anything, and I'll be left to hide in the shadows once again.
What about your students?
I have had some students come up to me just asking, like, what does this mean? Because they're 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds. I have to sit there and explain it to them. And then I have to tell them that, hey, I'm one of those people. I'm under DACA. And they just can't believe it because they're like, but you speak English well and you're a teacher. how is this possible? It's hard when you've been here since you were 3 years old and the president pretty much takes away any right that you did have to be here.
That's Ramon Ramirez, a DACA recipient, also known as one of the so-called dreamers. Thanks for sharing your story. Members of President Trump's family and associates will be back in the crosshairs of congressional committees investigating whether his campaign colluded with Russia, something also being looked at by special counsel Robert Mueller. This week, Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, acknowledged that the Trump Organization was pursuing a Trump Tower real estate complex in Moscow in 2015. Cohen said he'd reached out to a press secretary for Russian President Vladimir Putin about approvals. Joining me now for more is criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent Jack Rice. So, Jack, why is this significant?
Well, it's fascinating in the first place because President Trump, even President-elect Trump, said, I have absolutely no businesses, no connections, and I've negotiated nothing with the Russians. I haven't done anything with Russians. In fact, he even went back further and said, the only thing I ever did was the Miss Universe pageant. Absolutely nothing else. Again and again and again. Mm-hmm. So this revelation is astounding because his own attorney is saying, we were absolutely doing this. Not only were we doing this, President Trump, Donald Trump, was aware of this because I told him directly at least three different times. In other words, this was an absolute, unequivocal lie.
Why would doing business with Russia during the campaign be a problem?
There's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is because of the potential conflict of interest. It also gives the Russians a deeper understanding of what it is that Donald Trump is doing, how he does business, what it means. But actually, there's another angle I'm thinking about. And frankly, I'm thinking about this as a former CIA case officer. How do I recruit somebody like Donald Trump if I were Russian intelligence? And the bottom line is, blackmail is always a potential motivating factor. In this case, if we have somebody who's running for the presidency who says unequivocally that I am absolutely not doing something, and I, as Russian intelligence, absolutely know that you are, that you have, and that you apparently continue to do so, the potential for what I can do with that information is astounding because it can drive this man to do things that I want him to do, which is what this is all about.
We know that Russia interfered with the presidential campaign. They hacked into the Democratic National Committee. They were putting out fake news reports about Hillary Clinton to discredit her. But what are some of the things that a foreign intelligence agency would do to try to get information and infiltrate a candidate that they wanted to know more about for whatever reason, like Donald Trump?
Well, if we think about what an intelligence organization is going to do in the first place, if you can find somebody who is going to do the things that you want them to do and want to do it anyway, great, then you simply work side by side. But there's other possibilities. If they can benefit financially, the potential is to dangle money, to dangle opportunities, dare I say it, to dangle a Moscow Trump Tower. You have that possibility. And if you take a look at some of the people that he was working with, they had very direct connections to the Kremlin. And in fact, the majority of those involved in that potential operation were directly connected to the Russian government. So there's that one piece. We also have that blackmail piece where potentially when the president-elect is lying about having no contact with the Russians, having no operations of any kind with the Russians, when in fact he absolutely was without question. His own people are acknowledging it now, and there's emails to back it up. So now you have the ability to twist this man and say, in the event that you don't do what we want you to do, and it can be very, very slight in terms of how you do this, guess what? That information could potentially get out to the wrong people. The Russians certainly have become very adept at using the media to manipulate stories. You think they wouldn't use this kind of information to manipulate this man for Russian benefit? Of course they would.
How much trouble could this pose for the president himself, or would this be more folks that were working for him?
That's a very interesting question because this could cut a couple of different directions. If you think about the number of people who have been interviewed by the FBI, interviewed by Congress, either behind closed doors or elsewhere, and provided false information either on behalf of the president or knowingly themselves, there is the potential potential that crimes may have been committed under those circumstances. And we have Bob Mueller, who's out there digging very, very deep, who's starting to understand and dig towards this very issue, who has the potential of indicting those involved. This isn't just about talking to people to try to have a better understanding. He has that power to actually indict. And what that does then is drive the chain up, meaning if you can get somebody who is simply one of the hangers-on, one of those who are in support of this president, the potential in the event that you think that the president is actually leading the charge for the Russians, if you will, then you actually twist that person to actually roll over on the president. That's the question, and that's what Bob Mueller, that's what his investigators are trying to do and trying to determine right now.
All right. Criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent Jack Rice, thanks for being with us. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Facebook is trending because it's in some demographic trouble. Now, Facebook's ad manager announced that the social network can reach 41 million 18 to 24-year-olds, 60 million 25 to 34-year-olds, and 61 million 35 to 49-year-olds using Facebook ads, which sounds pretty great. If you're an advertiser on Facebook, you're going to want to reach as many people as possible. Now, the 35 to 49-year-olds, Facebook says they can reach 61 million. There are 61 million, roughly, 35 to 49-year-olds in the United States. So not out of the realm of possibility that Facebook could reach every single person from 35 to 49, but they say make that claim, so we'll give them that benefit of the doubt. The issue arises when you look at the other age groups they cite. There are 45 million 25 to 34-year-olds in the United States. However, Facebook says they can reach 60 million, so that's 15 million more than actually exist. The same thing with 18 to 24-year-olds. Facebook says they can reach 41 million. There are 31 million in the United States, so about 10 million more people that don't exist that Facebook says they can reach.
that could be a problem.
Yeah, a bit of a problem there. A lot of people taking note of this and saying that the numbers are off. Facebook is inventing about 25 million people that don't exist and maybe inflating their ad numbers.
We've already got overpopulation issues on this planet. Let's not add anybody.
Let's not add any mystery people, right? This has been an issue that's come up time and time again across social media and digital advertising. These are big money makers for these companies, and so they try to sometimes inflate and up the numbers.
Right.
In this case, Facebook got caught a little bit with that. They also add, however, that they're always working to improve their estimates. So I imagine that after this, they're going to be improving those numbers, maybe readjusting them a little bit to remove those 25 million people that just aren't there.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at the latest movies coming to U.S. theaters. And for that, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff. So, you've got a creepy clown movie to talk about.
But you know this clown movie.
I don't know.
You know, it's a Stephen King, it's a very famous Stephen King novel, and it was a miniseries in the 80s, you know. And now they just brought it to the big screen, you know, give it an updated, fresh translation with some young, new filmmakers and a young cast. It's just amazing. But if you don't know the story of it, because, you know, it's a 1,500-page book, you know, I've never read a Stephen King book, but I hear that it is amazing. And it takes place in Derry, Maine in the summer of 89, and these preteens known as the Losers Club, they fight this demon that takes on different shapes depending on its victim's worst fears. And so it kills children. I know, it's really dark and disturbing. So dozens of children in their town go missing. So these kids figure out what this clown is doing, and they seek it out, and they want to get rid of it so it stops killing these children. But they also face their own personal demons. It's a coming-of-age movie, you know, so it's got growing pains with, you know, girls and being teased by bullies. Don't fool yourself. This isn't a kid's film. This is a hardcore R-rated film with really disturbing images, with disturbing scenes with the clown and deaths. And so it's kind of balanced. I know. It's really creepy. It's really creepy. But I'm telling you, if that's your cup of tea, you're going to love it. I mean, I had a great time with it because I was looking out from underneath the seat. I was, like, laughing. I was crying. It had a whole gambit of emotions. Even though it takes place in 89, it feels like it was made in the 80s. The music and the Spielberg directed parts of it. So, you know, I was really surprised how much fun this movie was in terms of the laughs, the cries, and the screams.
Oh, okay.
I know.
I just have to skip being scared movies, but I know a lot of people like that, so at least they
Absolutely.
Know it's a good scary movie.
Absolutely.
And then we've got American Assassin with Michael Keaton. What's the story here?
Well, this is, you know, a very famous series of books by Vince Flynn, and this is the first of 15 novels that he did that CBS Films acquired the rights to, and they're hoping to make it a franchise with Dylan O'Brien. And he's a counter-espionage agent, Mitch Rapp. And Mitch was on the beach with his fiancée, and these terrorists, these Islamic terrorists, shot up the beach, real graphic opening to the movie. So he seeks revenge on them, but he's doing it himself. He's seeking out the terrorists himself by learning all of their culture and learning their language and trying to infiltrate the cell himself. And, of course, the CIA gets a hold of him and knows what he's doing, and they give him over to Michael Keaton, who's like one of their top trainers. Now, he's not being trained as a spy. He's being trained as a killer. So if the movie is about Michael Keaton and him going into underground and undercover to find out who stole a nuclear weapon. I know. Listen to this. I'm watching this movie, and usually, you know, art imitates life, you know, but this is like, this is really disturbing.
Too
watching.
Close to home.
It was. You know, I can turn on the news anytime and watch, you know, a nuclear weapon being aimed at America lately. So watching this movie, I was really squirming going, look, this isn't fun. This is really bad timing for this movie. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, you know. And then the whole third part of the movie fell to all these cliches for every action film, the counting clock, the double agent, the rogue, and you're just sitting there going, really? This is like every plot cliche and twist in every action film. So I was kind of disappointed in it, and I was kind of bored.
Well, we can skip that and go for scary clowns, I guess.
Definitely. That's what you want. Be scared.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, fans are rejoicing after a wildly popular American star has just released a highly anticipated new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
Taylor Swift, who is back after about a year or so break, which is typical for her. Her last album was 1989. And she usually takes a couple of years off in between albums, so she's back, and we've waited a while, but we'll have to wait a while longer for the next album. Album number 6 for Taylor Swift is called Reputation. It comes out November 10th. Can't tell you anything about it, aside from the first single, which is just exploding everywhere. It is setting all kinds of video view records. To put it in perspective, in the debut for her in the first 24 hours, 8 million views, which is huge in 24 hours. And she has already surpassed Gangnam Style, Despacito, all of these song views in as far as a one-week span that it's been out. It came out last Sunday at the MTV Video Music Awards. And since that time, Vivo has over 216 million views. And YouTube, 63 million views. So the video is hot, the song is hot, and it's appearing everywhere except one place, on the charts. And people are saying, well, you would expect it to be number one.
Right.
It was released after the cutoff date for last week's chart.
Oh.
See, so that allowed Despacito to tie the most weeks at number one for a song, which goes back to 95 and One Sweet Day, the song from Boyz II Men and Mariah Carey. Despacito's now 16 weeks number one. But some people are predicting, and we won't know this for sure until about Thursday, that Taylor Swift will kick it off the top spot, which would spoil its opportunity to break the record. We're talking about Despacito. The video for this song is very interesting. Let's get into it after we check out the song. Here is Taylor Swift's new one, Look What You Made Me Do.
Don't like your little games. Don't
Now, apparently, Larry, this song has received some mixed reviews.
Only in that the fans are looking for some catchy hook that really isn't there. It doesn't have the same kind of hook that, you know, Bad Blood or some of her past songs have. However, the young Swifties, the Taylor Swift fans, they're going to fall in love with everything she does. And it's a long-awaited song. People were wondering, is she returning to country music? Because that's where she got her start, in country music. But no, it looks like this sound from this particular single anyway is still like 1989's album, and she's in the pop world. Now, the video is very interesting because a lot of people are immediately assuming this was inspired by the feud between Kanye West and Taylor Swift, because they had that little thing from 2009 at the MTV Awards where he got on stage, took the award out of her hand, and said, Beyonce deserves this.
Oh.
And that created a big thing, and then they apologized, kissed, and made up. But last year, Kanye came out with a song called Famous, and in his video, it had a naked Taylor Swift. That started the feud again. So a lot of people believe this is inspired by Kanye and her feud. Not so. Some people believe it's the Katy Perry Taylor Swift feud. She says, not so. She says, this is about myself. This video is kind of making fun and parodying myself. There's one scene where she's sitting in a bathtub filled with diamonds, and there's a dollar bill in there. What's the significance of that $1 bill? She recently won a lawsuit against the Denver DJ who had grabbed her behind, and all she sought in the lawsuit was a dollar. So there's all kinds of subtle innuendo in this video. So it's kind of interesting. You got to see this video and watch closely because you'll miss, you know, something.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Oh, look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me. Ooh, look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Azerbaijani authorities have arrested Memon Aliyev, editor-in-chief of Turin Information Agency, and sentenced him to 3 months of pretrial detention pending trial on charges of tax evasion and abuse of power. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We are deeply troubled by the August 24th arrest and 3 month pretrial detention of Memon Aliyev, the prominent editor-in-chief of Azerbaijan's only remaining independent media outlet, Turin Information Agency. Other restrictive actions against Turin include freezing its bank accounts and initiating tax evasion charges against it, are also troubling. These actions by the government of Azerbaijan to curtail freedom of press and to further restrict freedom of expression," said Ms. Nauert, "are the latest in a negative trend that includes the government's May decision to block access to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and other independent media websites. The United States urges the government of Azerbaijan to immediately release Memon Aliyev and all those incarcerated for exercising their fundamental freedoms, in accordance with its international and OSCE obligations."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.